Coming up, got Nick Wright talking about the Lakers and Wolves, ripple effects from that series, what it means for the Lakers' future, what it means for the rest of the NBA playoffs, with seven questions about the NBA playoffs. And then after that, I got my mock draft going solo, every pick in the first round. Welcome back to the KOC show. We got a good one today from First Things First on FS1 and What's Right with Nick Wright on YouTube and everywhere you get your podcasts. It's Nick Wright. What's up, Nick?
A lot is up. I'm covered in shame, incorrect predictions, losing futures bets, and I'm greeted by an autographed Rudy Gobert jersey that's going to taunt me this entire podcast, as Rudy Gobert looked like freaking Wes Unseld last night with the big shock that Maxi Kleber's 5 minutes didn't fix it. Good to see you, KOC.
Nick, when we planned on doing this show on this Thursday, I did not expect this series to be over with the Wolves winning it, because you and I both picked Lakers over Rockets in the semis. You had your little viral post that everybody's going after.
Oh, I forgot about that one. Oh, congrats on the Lakers. I'd like to be the first to congrats to the Lakers on beating the Houston Rockets to advance Western Conference Finals. I legitimately forgot that I had tweeted that. Here's the thing. The benefit to not checking your mentions is you just don't know when you're getting dragged. So there's a lot. I'm sure there's a lot. What about I did a whole bracket, and the bracket ends with the Lakers winning the championship. They didn't get out of round one. So I'm probably getting crushed today. I deserve it, because my analysis was just way off. I am, though, shocked. I am legitimately, and it's not out of disrespect to the Timberwolves. It's more out of dismay that this is the Lakers team, KOC, that I saw 3 weeks ago go to Oklahoma City against that defense, full strength Thunder team, and drop 126 on them. And then 2 days later have 110 or whatever they had when Luka got thrown out with 6 minutes left. My thought process on the Lakers was not that, oh, their defense is going to be awesome. My thought process was, there's proof of concept that the defense can be passable and the offense is going to be elite. And it never came to fruition. And now they're done in five. And they could have last night, they could have gotten beaten by 30 points. That was the fakest close game of the playoffs.
Oh, for sure it was. I mean, the Timberwolves had the worst three-point shooting performance in playoff history, 7 for 47, worse than the Rockets' 0 for 27 Game 7 loss almost a decade ago at this point.
I didn't see that. That's amazing.
I mean, like 7 for 44 in that game when Houston had their 0 for 27 stretch. Minnesota went 0 for 18 stretch in that second half. Anthony Edwards obviously couldn't hit anything. Minnesota wins that game because of Randall and Gobert. But yeah. I think to your point, Nick, I overestimated this Lakers offense as well. I thought this Lakers offense would be able to generate a lot of buckets regardless of how great Minnesota's defense has been since Gobert got healthy in March. I thought this team would be very hard to stop, and maybe that's in part Luka sick game three, hurts his back game five. LeBron kind of poured it all out in the middle of that series. He seemed a bit more fatigued at the end. But also, I look at this team in JJ's offense, this was a thing among Lakers fans during the season. Do they run enough structured plays? Or is it too much your turn, my turn? And I do feel like that's part of it with this team. And, of course, not having a lob threat for Luka, which is part of what made him so effective in Dallas as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of things you can, specific things you can point to over the course of the series. I felt like we didn't get last night elimination game LeBron, and that was surprising to me. And then in retrospect, I look at it and I'm like, we did get elimination game LeBron. We just got it in game four because he thought that was the elimination game, and he was right. Like where LeBron game three, LeBron tried to steal one and was like, listen, Luka doesn't have it. What will likely go down, I said it Monday on the show, I think, you know, the overwhelming odds are this past Friday night, that's the most points LeBron will ever score in a playoff game again. 38. Like, is he going to have a 40-point playoff game at age 41? Probably not. You know what I mean? Like, that was probably the last, like, super high-level scoring game, and they ran out of gas at the end. And then game four, he clearly looked at it as our only chance of winning the series is winning that game, poured it all out offensively for the first three quarters, and then saved whatever energy he had left for the defensive end with those great defensive sequences at the end, and they lost anyway. And listen, he has a part of that. That turnover at the end was bad. They called the foul on the Anthony Edwards strip. You know, so be it. And then last night he didn't have it, and Luka didn't have it. And so I am not going to, for a team that I thought legitimately was going to win the Western Conference. It wasn't like, I want them to. I respected Minnesota, but I thought the bracket fell perfectly for him. I'm like, Houston, Golden State is going to be an absolute war. And even if Golden State gets through it, they're going to be beat up by it. I think correctly thought Denver and the Clippers are both going to be a pain in the ass for Oklahoma City and live dogs, whoever gets through it. And the Lakers are going to have a young team with one superstar to beat in Minnesota, and then a young team with no superstars in Houston, or a fatigued Golden State team, similar to when the Lakers beat Golden State 2 years ago, when Golden State had to go seven against Sacramento. Steph had the brilliant game seven, but then they were kind of out of gas. That's how I saw this playing out. And in part, it was because I was like, well, Luka's going to be the best player on the court, and LeBron and Anthony Edwards will kind of go back and forth for second, third, you know, third, second. Instead, it wasn't that at all. And the fact that the Timberwolves just controlled a game from start to finish, where Anthony Edwards was 5 of 19 and 0 for 11 from 3, shows how deeper their roster was and how much better they were. And they deserve all the credit in the world. And sorry, I'm kind of ranting. I don't mean to. It's such an interesting Anthony Edwards thing, where now the two biggest wins of his career, he's been bad in both games. Game 7 against Denver, he put up the Kobe Game 7 stat line. He was 6-24. And they won it. Last night, he was 5 of 19. And both games, damn Rudy Gobert, your guy. Rudy Gobert with the turnaround jump shot against Jokic, and Rudy Gobert with the damn near 25-25 game against the Lakers.
To your point, though, about Ant, like, he didn't have it offensively, but where I think I underestimated the Wolves was their defense. He's part of the reason why Reeves struggled. Reeves was 4-15 when defended by Ant in the series. Luka was 18-39 when defended by McDaniels. And then LeBron was only 10-25 when defended by Randle. So the primary matchups in this series that Minnesota chose were effective. And then naturally, the Lakers are going to do everything they can to pull Rudy Gobert out to the perimeter. And they did not have success against Rudy Gobert. Luka was 7 of 17 when matched up against Gobert. LeBron was 6 of 21. Reeves was 6 of 18 against Gobert. Total of 19 of 56, 33.9% from the floor when the Lakers' big three had a one-on-one against Rudy Gobert. That's not good enough. And it goes against the whole narrative about Rudy Gobert being a liability when he's on the perimeter. He's improved ever since the Steph Curry spin cycle. He's a different guy on the perimeter, and it's different than Utah because he has Jaden McDaniels and Anthony Edwards and Julius Randle and these big, Nikhil Alexander-Walker, big versatile defenders behind him on the back line, and not Joe Ingles and help defense. Okay, it's a lot better for Gobert.
Listen, we don't need to hold on. So Gobert deserves a ton of credit, and I thought was really good, obviously, defensively in this series prior to last night. Now, he had as many rebounds last night as he had in the series prior to last night.
That's
a crazy
stat.
Last night. I think it's actually he had 25 in the first four games and 24 last night. And then points wise, I think he had 17 points total. The first, in fact, I have it right here. I'll look real quick. I don't have it right here anymore. Regardless, he had less than 24 or 27 points, which is what he had last night. He had 2, 6, 1, 5. So that's, he had 14 points in the series, and then he had 27 last night. So that's a great, remarkable performance by him. One of the only things I got right about this series up until last night going into it was I was less concerned about the Lakers' lack of size against Minnesota than I would have been other teams, because Minnesota doesn't like to give Rudy the ball. Like, and he doesn't typically deserve the ball. And so I was like, listen, I know he's going to be 6 inches taller than the guy guarding him. They're not going to give him the ball on the block and ask him to do his terrible little baby hook so that he's not going to be able to punish him for it. And he really hadn't punished him until last night on the glass, which was really a shock. It's one of the few things the Lakers, again, prior to last night, executed well. The reason I said let's stop is all of that can be true, and he can deserve massive credit for this series. It doesn't mean we need to relitigate some really bad Utah series where he was bad and you guys won't admit it.
And he was bad offensively a lot of those, and well, and maybe that's why Minnesota will have issues in a future round because of Gobert's limitations on offense. But he was sensational defensively in this series. He did his job defensively, and his
job on the perimeter, he didn't get. Yeah, there was a couple highlights, but he held his own. He was great. He was great, and he was tough. And it was, I never thought I would get to this point. But I will admit, I was watching last night, and at one point I was like, man, they might just have to go to hack a Gobert to get him out of the game. And then I'm like, what has this come to? What has this come to?
Are you kidding me? You had that thought?
Yeah, I did. When they couldn't get a rebound, and this guy still can't make free throws, I'm like, do what the Warriors do to Steven Adams. And I hate that strategy. Mm-hmm. So I felt dirty for wanting them to do it. But it occurred to me, I was like, yeah, man, get the big French guy off the court. He's killing us. He's just killing us.
And when Kerr did it against Houston, it worked. Udoka pulled him right away, which I think was a mistake. So if Redick did try that, it might have actually worked out. Who knows if Finch would have accommodated what Redick was hoping for. But ultimately, for the Lakers, Mark Williams, he's posting on Instagram and putting a wink face on social last night. He's kind of like, oh, yeah, you should have kept me. You missed me. I would have helped. The Lakers, they have an incomplete roster, right? Like, that's part of why they lose this series. Ultimately, though, I still think, with the roster as was, it should have been more competitive than it was.
Yes.
And that's in part, you know, JJ Redick getting ripped today, and rightfully so. He plays all five starters the entire second half in game four. And then before game five, he storms away from the podium after getting asked about it. I didn't love the way the question was framed, but there's no reason for him to talk in such a condescending manner in the way he did, when all he had to say was, I'm like, lessons are learned, we're going to reevaluate, give a Belichick type of answer, like just very dry, we're going to reevaluate things and do better this game, right?
And KOC, do you listen when you watch these games, do you have the sound on?
Yes, sometimes.
Okay.
Sometimes. I sometimes do, I sometimes don't.
So the reason I'm mentioning it is, the sideline reporter, Allie LaForce? I don't want to get it. I hate when I get that wrong, but whomever it was, did something I've never seen a sideline reporter do, which is kind of give a take mid game, it must have been so noteworthy that she didn't feel like she was giving a take. It was just like her reporting. But it was reporting on JJ's disposition before the game, which was, she was like, he was wound up. He was on edge. He was super tight. And here is what I believe about JJ Redick. I think that he did an excellent job this year, I think, objectively. I was saying that if someone had included him on their Coach of the Year ballot, he deserved it. I thought he was a massive, exponential upgrade on Darvin Ham. And I think he's going to be a very good coach. With all that said, when he got hired, I said my concern was that I think when he hits a rough patch, his general smug, condescending nature, that I am just basing that off of who he's been the entirety of his public life, so 20 plus years, I think that could go poorly. And I think he's super online and very aware of what people are saying. And I think those are two things that could be tough parts of being an NBA head coach, much less coach of the Lakers. I'm going to add another concern, even though I think he's a very good coach. And people are, this is something I said it on my pod earlier. I'm going to say it on TV. I'll say it to you. This is, people are going to clip this and people are going to make fun of this take. They are going to say this is a ridiculous thing to say. I just believe it in my bones. We now have a 20 plus year history of JJ Redick being wound so tight, he doesn't perform in the biggest spots. JJ Redick, as one of the best college basketball players of his era, was a bad NCAA tournament player. He was great in every other setting. Go check those Duke game logs and go check what those teams did and what he did in the NCAA tournament. JJ Redick, as Jerry West reminded us, was not a great playoff performer in the NBA, even for his role. And now in his first shot in the playoffs, he, I think, made a big mistake and didn't want to really take full accountability for it. I think you can overcome it. And I think it's easier to overcome as a coach than it is as a player, because it's more just about mindset and you don't have to actually, you know, make shots. But I think he is wound so tight that he might not be the best pressure performer. And I think you saw some of that manifest itself even last night, when he boxed himself in before the game by saying Jackson Hayes isn't playing. And then all of a sudden it's like, all right, I guess I'm pressing the Maxi Kleba button here, which is a tough
button to push.
Who hadn't played
in 3 months at all for the Lakers or practiced.
Exactly right.
Barely either. Crazy.
Yep. Exactly right.
I don't think that take is crazy, Nick, because I have the same exact thought. He has always been an underperformer in the postseason. And, you know, maybe that was in part smaller guy, you know, only 6'4" or so. Sometimes it's different in the postseason. But then you're right. The NCAA stats for him, when Duke got eliminated when he was a freshman, 4-14 from the floor. He was 5-17 in the round of 32, way back his freshman year. His sophomore year, his last year at Duke, 3-18 in their elimination game in the Sweet 16. So it goes back to college. It happened in the NBA. And then it happens in the first round here after that pregame presser where clearly the dude is wound so tight.
And also clearly
the fact he brought up unprompted, is this about me being inexperienced?
Yes.
The reporter never said anything about that. JJ brought that up.
And I didn't think the reporter, I don't know who the reporter was. I couldn't pinpoint the voice.
Either.
But it didn't sound like the reporter was trying to be antagonistic. It did sound like anyone that's ever had that job, the open press conference question, I think people have experienced the, oh, it's my turn to ask the question. I know what I want to ask. I'm a little nervous about how I'm phrasing it. So I might talk a little too long or stumble over, you know, so it felt to me like the reporter was a little nervous himself, but not trying to be antagonistic. It did not seem like the reporter was like, hey, so you screwed that up because you're young and dumb. Are you going to do that again? That's not what it felt like at all.
I totally agree.
JJ took it like the guy was being either unfair or rude or disrespectful, and just listening to it, that's not what it sounded like to me. Sounded like a guy who was trying to basically be like, hey, Are you going to lean on some of your assistants, you know, because you're in the heat of the moment? And JJ, Doth protest too much a bit about that, I thought.
I felt exactly the same way. And ultimately for JJ, it was an incomplete roster. They tried trading for Mark Williams for a reason. Yep. It didn't work out. And also your best players just didn't perform the way they should have. And I feel, you know, this is the takeaway again involving Luka, but I feel for him, if you're Luka, you see the things LeBron does. He sets a tone on defense. He moves off the ball. He sets screens for you. He's cutting to the basket. He's become a high volume catch and shoot guy from three. This is all why it worked for LeBron back in Miami, the sacrifice next to Wade and Bosch. It's part of why he's still as good as he is, over 40 years old. It's also why Luka has never won a title. It's why Luka leaves us wanting more, because he has not improved in some of those areas as a cutter, as a mover without the ball. He's only worsened defensively as well. And I think with Luka, it's true to say Luka's better than almost everybody in the world at the game of basketball, but it's also true to say he's not as great as he should be or could be, which is why I think Luka is at another fork in the road here. And it's different this year with the Lakers. There's more media attention. There's more pressure here, better teammates, a better potential to win a championship. At this fork in a road, on one path, you have the LeBron path with Luka, where you do the extra things that makes you 10% greater than you already are. It leads to winning. And then there's the other path that I think he's already halfway down, and that's the James Harden path. And that's a Hall of Fame career, but no titles because of some of those shortcomings that continue to snowball as you get older, an unwillingness to play off the ball, an unwillingness to commit to defense, a lack of true leadership. And that's the path that I think Luka is going down right now, unless he reverts back and starts going down that LeBron path and following that lead. My confidence has waned a little bit. I'm nowhere near like the Nico level of I'm going to trade this dude. It's still a dumb trade to make. But at this point, Nick, has your confidence level in Luka to fix some of those flaws waned at all?
No. And here's why. I think that obviously this year was in a lot of ways a step in the wrong direction. There's no denying it. But the last time he had a step in the wrong direction. So Luka's career has kind of gone now. We've seen this twice where it's going on this undeniably upward trajectory. And culminating in the first iteration of it in the, for what was, and people will rewrite the history on this, the shocking in the moment upset of Phoenix in round two, with the game seven blowout where he outscored Phoenix himself in the first half, making a conference finals, beating the defending Western Conference champions before losing in the conference finals to the eventual champion, Golden State Warriors. It was all upward. And then a step back, the tank year, and trade for Kyrie, it doesn't get together, and they miss the playoffs. And then an absolute rocket ship the next year, where once again, Luka, and this is where I push back, and I think you'll agree with this part, on the Harden comparisons, Luka is not a playoff shrinker. He's an all-time playoff performer, and where he raises his game, this year was the exception, in the postseason, where he takes a team that no one had in the finals, past Oklahoma City. I don't even remember who they beat in round one, but then past Shea and Oklahoma City in round two, the one seed, past the talk of the town, the Minnesota Timberwolves and Anthony Edwards, in a series that at the end of it, Anthony Edwards said he was out of gas and Luka was not. And then they run into Boston and Boston beats them. And everyone, you know, revisionist history talks about the Mavs defense because that's a way to poke at Luka, when in reality, the Mavs defense in the finals was excellent. The Mavs defense in the finals held Boston well below its season averages offensively across the board. The Mavs just couldn't score the ball. And Luka had some bad moments, most notably the, was it game three ejection or foul out and whatever it was. And then this year, a step back emotionally because this team gave up on him. And then a step back performance-wise because for the first time in his entire career, he walked into a playoff series evenly matched or in the better position. His team lost, and a lot of it was because he didn't perform. So that is a legitimate criticism. But I still see this as a guy who is a top two offensive player in the league. In my opinion, a top three player. If people want to put Tatum and Shea ahead of him and say he's five, that's fine. I'm not ready to put Anthony Edwards ahead of him. And I think last night is evidence as to why, in that Ant can have the bad Ant games on the offensive end are so much of a lower caliber than the bad Luka games. And so Harden, people talk that the Harden issue is the heliocentricity or the lack of dedication to defense, all of that. That all can be true, while it's also true that if he wasn't a historic playoff choker, none of that would have mattered and they would have won a championship with him in Houston. Like, if all of the flaws of his game, if he simply was regular season Harden in the playoffs, they would have been fine and been a champion. And so even with the defensive woes and the ball dominance, at least I feel that way. And I mean,
Harden had some serious choke jobs. That's undeniable. It's true. Like, it's undeniable. Yeah. I'm a Harden guy, and I will admit that he has flopped in some of those end game moments, even going back to when he was in OKC, not just in the prime years in Houston. But he was also a guy who put up 38 and 6 every night, average wise, for five straight years in the postseason for Houston with some deep runs, going toe to toe with a historic opponent in the Golden State Warriors. So Harden had a very hard road in the West as well. And Luka has had some lows already. He was not great in that elimination game against the Warriors a couple years ago. He was not great in the series against Boston in the finals last year. And he wasn't great to close this series either. So that resume could build for Luka over time, despite these highs that we're talking about, because Harden had those highs too, with some amazing postseason performances.
Hold on. Harden did have some amazing playoff games. Harden, day before yesterday, was the 26th time in James Harden's playoff career he had more turnovers than made baskets. James Harden has had 54 career playoff games with four or fewer made baskets. This is where I will drastically disagree with you. I think Luka is one of a handful of guys who is an MVP caliber player in the regular season who raises his game in the playoffs. That is hard to do. That was some of the greatest players of all time are great because they just stay the same. Like Kobe and Duncan are two great examples. Two guys who didn't necessarily get better in the playoffs. Duncan maybe early in his career, but they didn't drop. You know, there's only a handful of guys. Joker is one, Jordan obviously, LeBron obviously. Luka has been on that trajectory of I'm great in the regular season, I get better in the playoffs. I am not as worried about Luka as everyone else is going to be, because listen, the knives are going to be out. You are going to see KOC by semi-credible people, top 10 lists going into next year, or, you know, a player ranking, and what you're going to see is Anthony Davis 10, Luka 11. Like, people are going to overreact.
That's absurd.
I'm telling you, I'm going to call my shot right now. Here is going to be someone's player ranking list. I'm going to try to do it. You're going to have Jokic, Giannis, SGA, Tatum, Ant. We're at 5. You're going to have Steph. You're going to have Wimby. You might have Wimby number one, God knowing you. So we're at 7. Donovan, Jalen Brunson, we're at 8, 9. And someone's going to put, I'm telling you, if you don't think you're going to get takes that this week that Jalen Brunson and or Tyrese Halliburton, if you're trying to win a championship, you'd rather have them than Luka Doncic. You don't know the media. That's coming.
Sure.
And I'm not ready yet to say Ant surpassed him. Now, like, I look at it more holistically. Like, they played in the playoffs last year. Luka was better, beat him in five. Ant ran out of gas. They played in the playoffs this year. Ant was better. Ant beat him in five. They ran out of gas. Seems pretty even to me, but most people don't do the math that way. Let me ask you one more thing about Luke before we move on. And here is where I think the conditioning part gets a little overstated. How exhausted at the end of games do you think other superstars would look if they, like Luka the last 2 years, led the league in minutes per game in the playoffs? Meaning, like, Steph's a bad example because Steph is seemingly indefatigable and is running around the whole time or whatever it is. But what's also true is Kerr, much to the chagrin of dopey Warrior fans, basically puts a ceiling on how many minutes they'll play Steph, particularly early in series. And it's like, listen, we are protecting him because of what we're asking from him. And so, yes, Steph is fresher. No doubt about it. And listen, Steph is in top 1% of humans ever condition. Luka is not that. But you understand the point I'm making, that nobody in the playoffs this year has played more minutes than Luka. Last year, nobody played within 100 minutes of what Luka played in the playoffs. And on a minutes per game level, I think only Maxey was more, and Maxey, you know, obviously didn't have a long playoff run. Would we, if Luka ever was on a team where they were like, hey, you can rest like a normal player even in the playoffs, would he look fresher at the end of these games? Probably.
He would, Nick. And to your point, putting a cap on his minutes could be good. But this is also on Luka, too. Sometimes you need to give up the ball. Play off the ball. Catch and shoot threes. Because in this postseason, look at the numbers. He had 46 total threes. How many of those do you think were catch and shoot threes of the 46 threes he took?
Four.
It was 13, a little bit more than you thought. 13. He made six of those.
I played that game poorly. Sorry. I don't know what I should have said.
46.2%. He shot 6 of 13 on catch and shoot threes, 10 of 33 on dribble jumper threes. If Luka is just going to embrace playing off ball a little bit more like LeBron has and get some of those easy catch and shoot threes, conserve some of that energy, to me that would help him a lot. I really do think that would help him a lot, and I hope it's something that he does in the years to come. But I've been hoping for that for years. I hoped it would happen playing next to Porzingis. I hoped it would happen playing next to Brunson. I hoped it would happen playing next to Kyrie Irving. I hoped it would happen playing next to freaking LeBron James, who is doing that, and it hasn't happened yet. And I hope if LeBron stays with the Lakers moving forward, he has a player option for next season. Obviously, you know,
he's staying with the Lakers.
I think he's staying with the Lakers as well. I'd be shocked if that didn't happen otherwise. But for the Lakers, assuming LeBron stays, Luka's back as well, what's the move you'd make if you're Rob Pelinka? Who are you going for, your number one target, to make this roster feel more whole?
So didn't somebody on TV say yesterday, Giannis? Yeah, I think Giannis would be good.
I don't think they have the assets.
No shit.
I don't think so. Whoever said that. I don't think he can.
You know, a trade that actually wouldn't have resulted in people rioting outside of your arena if you could have just held your water for three more months, Nico Harrison? Luka for Giannis, one for one. Defense wins champion. Like, for real. You're laughing. I'm being dead ass serious. Yeah. If you wanted to get out of the Luka business and you could have just waited, like, it's not shocking that Giannis, I know that I'm not answering your question. I just, quick sidebar. It's not shocking that Giannis might be available. That's a trade that I think you wouldn't have been, assuming the Mavs weren't going to go back to the finals, you wouldn't have been basking in the afterglow of a finals berth. And I think you might have been able to say, you know what? We do need more defense. We're going to get a little bit older, but, you know, at least it's we're trading for one of the only players in the league most people think is better than Luka. But all right, set that aside. What like, obviously, they need a big. It is there's not a lot of those guys available. I feel like the Lakers for 10 years have been trying to trade for Miles Turner. They haven't been able to pull it off, and now the Pacers are actually real good. So I don't think that's a possibility. Here's what I do feel. The only reason I'm okay with them rescinding the Mark Williams trade was because it felt like they were paying quite a steep price, and they now have those assets to make a more substantial trade, you know, moving forward. It's not going to be in free agency. They're not going to have the cap space. Now, like, to add a player like that, it's going to have to be a type of trade that they make, but it's obviously got to be what Anthony Davis told him to do, which is bring in a center. Like, that has to be the move.
And I thought LeBron was funny post game. He's asked about that as well, and he's like, "Well, AD, they got rid of him a week later."
You know who I bet would look really good with Luka? Derek Lively. You think he's available?
maybe Nico will help you out again.
I mean, I got to tell you, you got too many bigs in Dallas now. Yeah, so is there a name or two?
Wendell Carter with Orlando. Tom Haverstraw had an article on Yahoo Sports today about 5 trades he'd make if he were the Lakers. He mentioned Jared Allen from the Cavs if they fall short. That was one. Walker Kessler from the Jazz was another one. Walker Kessler is always the name that seems to pop up. Ultimately, the Lakers need a couple names here, you know, regardless of who they go for. I think Walker Kessler is the good one, but the price seems so immense from Utah right now. And for the Lakers and this year's draft class, I don't think it's for Lakers fans listening. I don't think this is a draft class to go for that type of player either that can help you right away. I want to talk about LeBron with you for a minute, Nick, because, you know, this is year 7 now with him. Year 1, 37 games, misses the playoffs, wins the title year 2, losing the first round year 3, then a 33-win team, misses the playoffs, swept in the conference finals the year after that, losing the first round last year in 5 games, losing the first round again this year in 5 games. You think LeBron's the GOAT? I'm right there with you. But if this were his final season in LA, whether retirement or whether he decides to leave or whether the Lakers decided to go in a different direction, how would you remember LeBron's legacy in LA?
I mean, he saved the Lakers. Seems good. They had the worst 6-year stretch in the history of their franchise. Within 18 months of signing him, they won a championship. Also, there's a weird thing the media does about LeBron runs the team on the moves that don't work, but doesn't on the moves that do work. One thing everyone is in agreement on is he was instrumental in them getting Anthony Davis. So that means he was instrumental in them winning a championship and then getting Luka Doncic. So, like, here's the problem that I have and why I'm not as interested as people would expect me to be in the, like, LeBron, what does this year mean for his legacy discussion? If we are just comparing him to NBA history as a whole, everyone just objectively understands, well, it's the greatest old guy season ever. He's the greatest 40-year-old ever. He's he had the greatest year 20, year 21, year 22 ever. Everybody knows all of that, but people don't. That's not really what they're trying to do. They're trying to compare him to Michael Jordan. But then if you're like, okay, then I guess what we're comparing it to is Jordan's Wizards years, right? Because that's the same age. People are like, no, those don't count. Give me a break. It's like, okay, so we're comparing year 21 LeBron at age 40 against what, year 12 Jordan at age 35? That doesn't seem very fair to me, but people aren't interested in being fair in it. So I don't I thought LeBron, I don't know where you had him, KOC, but I thought he had legitimate claim to the 5th MVP spot, or, and, you know, was like fringe first team, top of second team all NBA.
I had him fifth on the MVP ballot. I had him fifth on the All NBA as well.
Yeah. So I don't have a ballot, but I'd still do a fake one anyway. I don't look at All NBA exactly the same way I look at MVP, because I kind of want all NBA to be two guards, two forwards, a center the way it used to be. So I had him fifth on my fake MVP ballot, but second team all NBA, because the forwards were obviously Giannis and Tatum. But it's still, he was, over the course of this year, he was somewhere from the fifth to eighth best player in the league at age 40. And he has played more minutes than Damian Lillard and Jimmy Butler combined in their careers. So if people are then going to be like, well, he sure looked tired at the end of this game. So you think, man? So I think that's just like objective and the only fair way to do it. I don't think people are that interested in being fair about this conversation. And so, and as far as, you know, has he succeeded as a Laker? My answer to that is yes. And this is, again, where people to me are disingenuous. When he went to LA, the narrative was he does not care about winning anymore. It's because he wants to make movies. This is his retirement job. He now has been there for 7 years, not only restored them to relevance, brought them a championship, made another conference finals, and was instrumental in their ability to get Luka freaking Doncic. I think it's been a rousing success, but that's only because I'm fair about this stuff and not, you know, a shill.
Look, I wish I could disagree. I really wish I could disagree.
Yeah, but
look,
I mean, it's just so stupid. Like, what are we? I can't even believe it. Like, what did? I'm just curious. Like, so here's a fun one. Here's a fun one. Tom Brady is a Buck. Failure. You know how goddamn dumb that would sound.
It's ridiculous.
Like, well, they only won one championship, and I don't know. Like, I don't know. Like, what are we talking about? Like, you mean the guy who was the oldest guy ever to win and took a team immediately to a title and then kept them relevant and in the mix the rest of the way? It's like, well, yeah, you say that, but that final year in Tampa, they were a 500 team and got blasted in round one by the Cowboys. What does that do to his legacy? It's so stupid. It's just so incredibly stupid.
For the listeners who are very angry about a lengthy Lakers talk, on tomorrow's pod with Tom Haverstraw, we're going to be going deeper into every series. But with Nick today, I have one question for you about a bunch of other stuff happening around the NBA. So we'll go kind of rapid fire through some of these.
And by the way, don't apologize. Hold on, KOC.
I don't think I said the word sorry. I said for the listeners who are mad about it.
Oh, okay. All right, I'm not sorry. Okay.
I'm not sorry, and
I understand that there's a lot of hipster NBA fans that listen to this show, and I get that. The Los Angeles Lakers just lost in round one. It happened 12 hours ago. It's a big story. Now go ahead. I'll do your other stuff. Sorry.
Number one, the Minnesota Timberwolves. Do you think the Wolves want Golden State or Houston in their next round series?
Well, they want Houston. I would, even though they would have home court against Golden State, I think they would want Houston because, to me, there's a lot of Houston that right now just feels, and again, this is a little prisoner of the moment, I understand, it just feels like a kind of poor man's Minnesota, like a Minnesota team with just a worse offense and without a go-to superstar. And, you know, so Houston is going to feel like it has a hard ceiling as long as Jalen Green, you know, continues to be the exact same player he was in year two, which is who he's been. And so like that, and Şengün is going to continue getting better, obviously, as will Amen Thompson. I love a lot of their players. I really do like a lot of their players, but
you're just missing a star. They have everything else but the star. That's the issue.
Exactly right. And so listen, Amen maybe can be a star one day, but His free throws make me nervous. I'm like, man, if you're that bad of a free throw shooter, are you ever going to be like a legitimate scorer? And Şengün, maybe, listen, I was burnt once by underestimating a player that looked a lot like Şengün early in his career, and I don't know if I want to be burnt by it again. But I don't think he has superstar upside. I think he has perennial all-star upside, but I don't know that he has superstar upside.
No, he's Jokic light. He's not Jokic. Yeah. Jokic is an all-timer. That's what he became. Şengün is more, you know, he's like the Charmander to Jokic being Charizard. That's just what it is with Şengün. And so for Houston, yeah. I'm with
he's
you.
Rich man's Domantas Sabonis and a poor man's Nikola Jokic, right?
Perfectly like said. I agree. Yes, he has some of the stuff that Sabonis is missing. Defense, yep. Just kind of that toughness and grit as a scorer. The flair that Şengün has that Sabonis is missing. So I agree with you. If I'm Minnesota, I want Houston to have the 3-1 comeback, which I don't think that's going to happen, unfortunately. I picked Houston in the series. I think Golden State probably closes it out tonight. Number two, did the Rockets find something that works in Game 5, or is that a one-off? I don't think so. I think the Warriors close it out. What do you think?
Well, listen, I don't think they found anything. The Warriors are prone to do this. The Warriors,
happened a couple years ago.
Right. Even in their great runs, they just have a playoff game, it seems, where they just kind of early on, they're like, we ain't got it. Forget it. We'll just punt this one. And so that I wouldn't read too much into it. What I would say is this. The Rockets seem unblowoutable. And by that, I mean, in this specific matchup, that as soon as Steph goes to the bench, the Rockets have the Warriors have such a hard time scoring that even if the Warriors find themselves up 14, 16 points, as they have in a few of these games, the Rockets will claw their way back in. So I think that they are a live dog game 6 in Golden State. My pick was Rockets in 7. I thought at this moment it would be Rockets 3-2, not Golden State 3-2. And you feel obviously a hell of a lot better if the Rockets have two shots at it.
And it probably should have been if they hit their free throws in game 4.
Yeah, or if Şengün hits the 12-footer. You know what I mean? Ugh. And so it's just like, so to me, this series is really close, but it's just hard. It's hard to trust Houston down the stretch of these games. You know what I mean? That's just the reality.
Mm-hmm. They really need Jalen Green to have one of his random on nights or Fred VanVleet to just catch fire from three, and he's prone to cold nights as well. Number three, Nuggets and the Clippers. After, I think it was game 2 or game 3 when the Clippers had their big victory, Kawhi looked like the best player on the floor. I said on my pod, I regret picking this to go 7. Clippers look like the better team. MPJ hurt for the Nuggets. Well, I mean, here we are now. Nuggets a chance to close that out. How stupid am I, Nick, for having any faith in the Clippers?
No, I don't think you're... I think it's this... I said this is might be the one series that was, you know, in question that before the series I might have nailed fully. My pick for this series was Nuggets in 7 with a bonus pick of at the 6-minute mark of the fourth quarter of game 7, it'll be a tie game. Like that, that's how close I thought this series was. And I think that's what we're tracking towards. I did find, and listen, it wasn't just you, it was everyone. It was everyone I respect. It was you, it was Zach, it was Bill, it was everyone in the podcast world.
Nuggets looked like they were on the ropes. Guys are hurt.
That part's not even what I'm talking about. And if MPJ had been out for the series, they don't have enough guys. That's what I was going to say. But everyone, I evidently didn't get the memo that after game 2 of this series, we all needed to be like, you know, if you think about it, Kawhi Leonard, the GOAT, maybe. Like that conversation was a little much for me. The like, oh my God, like that. And the Clippers obviously look terrifying when they have a guy who scores 39 on 75%. I thought my dear beloved colleagues in the media were a little too credulous on, well, This is just the Kawhi they're going to get from here on out. And so Kawhi's come back down to earth. Harden has, you know, as the games have ratcheted up, Harden's performance has ratcheted down. I still expect the Clippers to win tonight. And I think we'll have a great game seven that'll be tightly contested. But if it's tightly contested, you know, it's hard to go against Jokic.
Fourth question. I think the Pistons are going to make a 3-1 comeback, win the series against the Knicks. Do you agree with me?
I don't agree with you. I don't think the Pistons can win a game seven in MSG. Now, they've already won twice in MSG. What's crazy is going into that home game, everyone was like, man, the Pistons could get their first playoff win in Detroit since 2008. We're now going into game six, and they are still looking for their first playoff win in Detroit since 2008 because they've won both their games on the road. Obviously, they could have won game four if not for a tough no call. I have not been impressed by the Knicks here. Don't get me wrong, but I just think asking Detroit at its age to not only execute a 3-1 comeback, but to win a game seven in MSG will be a little too much. But I do think this, one of the biggest winners of round one is your Celtics. They got to be looking at this series like, give me a break. You thought our path last year was easy. And so I think that this, whoever wins this series is going to be absolutely annihilated by Boston.
Next question. Obviously, as you said, Boston versus whoever wins that series. So then we're going to have Cleveland versus the Pacers. The whole Halliburton thing that happened after the game with Giannis, it seems like it almost kind of distracted from what's Giannis's future in that conversation. Yeah. I asked Marcus Morris the same question earlier in the week on my pod. I'm going to ask it to you as well, Nick. In order to keep Giannis in Milwaukee, is there anything that you think the Bucks can do to make that happen?
I mean, that's a hell of a question. I don't think there's anything realistic that if Giannis's number one goals, and by the way, it doesn't have to be this, but if his number one goal is to have a realistic chance to win a championship next season, then there's nothing Milwaukee can do. There just isn't, right? Like there is no trade, there is no move they can make, and it's not like you can ask Giannis to level up. I mean, he has level. He's as good, if not better, than he was when they won a championship. And so what I'm worried about, to be totally honest, I think a Giannis-Rockets trade, you know, there are some good ones that make a lot of sense. I think that would be really cool.
Şengün for Giannis?
Yeah. So this is the trade I put together. And this might even be more than you have to give up. Şengün, Reed Shepard, Jock Landale, both Phoenix picks. That feels like pretty fair value. And you know what I mean? Like that's and you and the Rockets obviously have their own.
You need
own
to
picks
give up more first. I think you,
okay.
I think
all right.
Milwaukee
so
needs more
so
first.
Şengün
has more first. They can give up as well.
No, so they could do this. Şengün, Reed Shepard, Jock Landale. The 27 and 29 Phoenix firsts, and then two of their own firsts, two of Houston, so 28 and 30 Houston firsts. You get four firsts, Reed Shepard, who's top five pick, Şengün, who makes you competitive immediately, which you need to be because you don't have your own picks. Like, that would make sense. Here is my nightmare scenario. Stephon Castle, a bunch of other stuff, and 100 picks to the Spurs, because I am very, very confident that the LeBron James is the greatest basketball player ever take is going to age like fine wine, and kids are going to look at LeBron versus Jordan and say, how was this ever a debate? The only thing that could threaten that is right around when it's becoming unanimous, your alien in San Antonio getting his seventh title because he and Giannis team up to form the greatest defensive team ever to live. And they start winning immediately. So I just want Giannis anywhere but San Antonio. So, but I think San Antonio could make an attractive package as well.
I know you have to run, so these last two questions, super rapid fire, sure. Nick. I got a Spurs-related question for you. Castle, Rookie of the Year photo was posted on social media by the Spurs. It has Castle and Tim Duncan and David Robinson and Victor Wembanyama. And Wemby in the photo, he looks 8 feet tall.
I think that's photo. A perspective thing.
Here's my thing, Nick. It might be a perspective thing, but I've been around Boban, who's listed at 7'4". I've been around Porzingis, who's 7'3". I've been around Taco Fall, who's 7'6". I've been around Wemby. I interviewed him. I think he's actually 7'6", 7'7". I think he's taller than his listed height. That's my feeling. Have you been around Wemby, and do you feel the same way?
No,
you do
I've never been around Wemby. I do buy his, because he used to be called 7'5". When he was in France, coming into the draft, they said he was 7'5". Yes. And then all of a sudden he became 7'4". Yep. So no, I think this is a perspective issue, but do I buy that he might be 7'6"? Yes, I do buy that.
Okay. And last question, you do your King of the Hill rankings on First Things First, your playoff player rankings. And I noticed on the one you did this week, Evan Mobley's not on it. What does Evan Mobley need to do to make your King of the Hill list?
So he was, to be fair, he was on it the previous week. Okay. He had dropped off. I'm going to be let me see where it was. Yeah, so I gave your guy Franz his spot, and Julius jumped and got a spot. So two guys had to come off. So I think that it didn't feel fair to drop Garland or Donovan. And it was because they won McDaniels, the series by 120 maybe. Points. But McDaniels was coming off with like a 30-point game. I obviously think Evan Mobley is better than Jaden McDaniels. As we say on the show, this is a rich tapestry. It's about how good you are, how well you've played, you know, recency bias, a lot of things. No, I think Mobley is awesome. And like deep, you know, do I think Mobley is better than Chet Holmgren? I actually think right now, this moment, the answer is yes. So that bottom row can always be a little tricky.
I know the feeling when it comes to player rankings, Nick. The bottom is always the toughest. Who do you leave off? Nick, appreciate you joining me today, man. This was a lot of fun.
Of course. Thanks for having me. Sorry for not being able to set it up earlier. Glad we're able to do it. Talk to you soon, KOC.
No, Nick, thank you. All right, big thank you to Nick Wright. Coming up next, my mock draft for the whole first round of the 2025 NBA draft. Today's mock draft, let's explore a possibility that hasn't happened before. The three teams with the 14% odds of landing the number one pick, Cooper Flagg, all fall out of the top four. It has not happened yet since the odds were flattened in 19, but there have been three instances in which the two of the three teams with 14% odds have fallen out of the top three. So let's get into this disastrous scenario with today's mock draft that would leave fan bases disappointed and others very happy. Because with the number one pick, we have Cooper Flagg going to the Brooklyn Nets with this randomized order from Tankathon. Cooper Flagg to the Nets, quite obviously, this is what they do. They have a clean slate this year. They have really nothing on their roster besides Nick Claxton and a couple other young guys, but all their guards are free agents. It's a total clean slate in Brooklyn. And if they were to get Cooper, they have a lot of picks. They have a lot of cap space. They could go in a bunch of different directions with him if they do end up getting number one. And within this draft guide, you can explore scouting reports for all of these players, strengths and concerns, comparisons for all of them that you can find in the link below in the description with the Yahoo NBA draft guide. At number two, we get the Pelicans moving up. New Orleans, Dylan Harper would be an interesting fit next to the existing pieces there. It'd work with a Trey Murphy type. It would work with a Herb Jones type. But with Zion Williamson, is there enough shooting? Because with Dylan Harper, as much as you like him, he's a shot creator, he's a good passer, he's a great finisher. Is all of these qualities, all of these strengths, but the shooting, as I note here, 27.8% shooter on dribble jumpers from two-point range, 29.2% from three. Can he be a primary creator in an offense that also has a non-shooter like Zion Williamson? That's going to be the big question for him, and I do worry about fit there with him, even though he has so many positive qualities. with the third pick, Ace Bailey for the Philadelphia 76ers. Like I note here, Sixers fans would be incredibly happy if they get their pick back, like, because it's the only top six protected. OKC could end up with it if it ends up seven or lower. Ace Bailey, though, does he help you? Like, if you get the number three pick, does he help you win with Joel Embiid and Tyrese Maxey and Paul George? I don't think so. He didn't help Rutgers win. To me, if the Sixers do move up into the top four, we're going to see this team be in a position where they look to trade this pick. Maybe if it's number one, you keep Cooper. But if it's number two, Dylan Harper, number three, Ace Bailey, or anybody else that comes after this, I'm not totally sold on Philadelphia keeping that guy. Number four, the Houston Rockets. BJ Edgecombe. Jalen Green's not that guy. Jalen Green's not that guy. That's become so clear in this postseason for the Rockets against the Warriors. He scores 38 in one game, single digits in every other game. He's one of the most frustrating players in all of the NBA. He's not that guy. BJ Edgecombe, is he that guy? I don't know. Like, he's not perfect. He didn't show up for Baylor the way that he should have as a potential top five pick in the NCAA tournament, but he is a versatile player. He is a superb athlete. That's why we have comps to Victor Oladipo in here, to Benedict Mathurin. Christian Brown is a comp I really like for him, because I think Edgecombe has 3-and-D skills that he can fall back on that would make him an interesting fit for them. And number five, got Con Knipple. This is an interesting spot for Utah. They have the top odds at 14%, the worst record in the league. If they don't get Cooper, if they don't get a top four pick, what do you do? Like, who do you take here? Because look at the next few picks. Let's spoil a little bit. Con Knipple at five. Are the Jazz going to take a big Malawach? I don't think so, with all the bigs they have. Are they going to take a guard like Jeremiah Fears or Trey Johnson? I don't think so. They have Keontae George. They have Isaiah Collier. So if they don't end up in the top three, I think Con Knipple fits a short-term need because of the guards they have and the bigs they have, but also fills a long-term need considering he's a 6'7 wing, a shot maker. He fits alongside all those other pieces. So there, the reason why I wanted to explore the mock in this fashion was because inevitably on lottery night, there's going to be some disappointed fan bases. Either the Jazz or the Wizards or the Hornets are going to end up crushed on lottery night. Maybe all three of them, maybe just one of them, maybe two of them. And what are they going to do if they fall? Because for the Wizards at six, if you fall this far, I have Malawach to them in this mock draft. Is Malawach going to be a great fit long-term next to Alex Saar in the front court? Maybe. But Malawach grabbed zero rebounds in his last game with Duke. He was a no-show. He's incredibly raw. Maybe Utah can, maybe Washington can survive in the short term. But long term, like, you're just kicking the can forward. Cooper is the prize here, and I don't see a lot of perfect fits for some of these worst teams in the league. Like, I'm concerned for these teams if they end up falling this far. At seven, Jeremiah Fears with the Hornets. They have 14% odds as well. If they fall this far, another guard next to LaMelo Ball, Jeremiah Fears, Trey Johnson, who are you going to end up taking? As I write here, LaMelo Ball is Charlotte's point guard today, but how sure are we that he's the point guard for the long term? I'm not positive about that. I don't think any Hornets fans are either. So Jeremiah Fears would actually make some sense, as you know, Charlotte has had multiple ball handlers. LaMelo can play off the ball. Jeremiah Fears gives you some short-term, a short-term guy who can play next to LaMelo, and maybe a long-term replacement if he ends up a star. And I like the Jamal Murray, Jordan Poole comps for him. I think he could end up a little bit better than Jordan Poole, though. Trey Johnson, got him going to the Toronto Raptors with the eighth pick. Trey Johnson, better playmaker than he gets credit for, even though these comps, Tyler Hero, Latrell Sprewell, underrated in his prime, by the way, and Nick Young, if things don't work out, see, if you scroll over the comps, some explanation appears. If things don't work out, Johnson could at least be a fun bucket getter to watch, and maybe a meme generator. True, Trey Johnson is a very fun player to watch, very emotional, wears his heart on his sleeve. Like I say here, the it factor. He'll toy with the crowds on the road, pump up the home crowd, always looking like a player who genuinely loves every aspect of basketball. I love Trey Johnson. I'm rooting for that dude to be really good. Number nine, Derek Queen, one of the beautiful players to watch in March Madness, had that leaning game-winning buzzer beater for Maryland. You pair him with Wemby in the front court, a lot of the concerns about Derek Queen disappear. These comps, DeMarcus Cousins, Zach Randolph, Naz Reid, what do all those guys have in common? Up and down defense. Queen's got a little bit of switchability, but he's more of a modern tweener. He's not a great rim protector. He's not yet proven as a perimeter guy either. So you pair him with Wemby in the front court, that's not going to matter. Wemby's going to protect everything at the rim if he gets blown by. And then offensively, Queen's creation ability, the shooting potential is going to manifest in ways that would make for a beautiful Spurs front court. Colin Murray-Boyle's got him to the 10th pick for the Portland Trail Blazers. Blazers had a top five defense after the All-Star break. Obviously, there's like a lot of meaningless games in there, but Portland trended up. Denny Avdia trended up. A lot of their young guys trended up over the course of the year. And Murray Boyles from South Carolina, I think, would be a great fit for that team, which feels big, long, versatile, and he'd add another defensive presence to that team. Got Jace, 11th pick here to the Dallas Mavericks. I mean, poor Mavericks fans. You trade Luka, 80 barely plays to end the season. Kyrie gets injured, and now he's going to be gone for the majority of next season. Assuming the Mavericks keep those guys, and there's no guarantees that they do, but assuming they keep AD and keep Kyrie and keep trying to contend for a championship, as Nico Harrison says they're going to do next year to prove everybody wrong, Jace Richardson is the type of guy that would make a lot of sense for the Mavericks, because in the short term, he can help fill gaps for Kyrie Irving and the shot creation that team is going to need. In the long term, Richardson showed this in Michigan State. What he does, I have the Derek White comp, the Rip Hamilton comp, because this guy is an off-ball wizard. He moves without the ball. He's got a great feel for the game. He's a cutter. He's a mover. He's a knockdown shooter off the catch. He does all these little things that would help him play next to star players while also providing a bit more creation earlier in the season. Get McNeely at the 12th pick for the Chicago Bulls. They want to be a shooting team, third in three-point attempts this season, but 13th in percentage. McNeely did not shoot threes quite as anticipated this year at UConn. Only 36.7 of his catch and shoot threes. But in high school, he was an elite shooter. He has these hot performances. I feel like McNeely is the type of guy that's going to be a really good shooter in the NBA. Get KJ, the 13th pick to the Atlanta Hawks. You know, I think with KJ, man, some people have him ranked in the top five. Some people have him outside the top 10. I think I have him 10th on my board. I haven't updated the board yet. He makes sense for Atlanta because the amount of turnovers this guy had this season just pissed me off, because the Akechonas would make this beautiful, you know, behind the back crossover, left-handed, no-look pass in one possession. And then the next play, he'd commit this bonehead turnover where it's like, what are you looking at? And I think if you're pairing that dude with Trae Young, it means he's going to have less demand on him to create, and it's going to highlight all the good things he does. The scoring ability, the shooting ability, the fact he's 6'6", he has size. And so I think playing him next to Trae would make a lot of sense and be really good for his career and good for Trae and the Hawks moving forward. Get Yegor to the Spurs with their second lottery pick here that they got from the Hawks because, you know, Atlanta just wanted to give up their pick here, unfortunately, for the San Antonio Spurs. Not unfortunately for the Spurs, unfortunately for Atlanta. But the Spurs get this pick. Yegor Demon, if they get him, add size, add a playmaker next to this group. I know I have them taking Derek Queen earlier, but what's the shame in having a big 6'9" shot creator? Is there a place you'd rather he end up being than San Antonio to help fix his jumper? I love the fit for Demon if he ends up there. Get Noah. You know I love French prospects. Noah has the same agent, plays for the same team as the legendary Killian Hayes. But Noah's bigger. He's 6'9". Noah's younger. He doesn't turn 19 until later in this year. He's got a different type of skill set. He's not a point guard with a theoretical jumper. He's a forward with versatility, a forward with fluidity on drives to the rim. That's why you get the Nick Batum comp in there. And he's somebody that flashes jumper potential. OKC, 15th pick. What have they done with these picks in the late lottery, mid-first? Alexei Pokushevsky, Usman Jang, these big home run swings. A lot of the times you're going to miss. Most of the time you're going to miss. Sometimes you're going to get lucky, like the Milwaukee Bucks did with Giannis Antetokounmpo. And so with Noah, I'm not saying he's going to be a superstar, but like there's a small possibility where I think a team like OKC, where you already have everything else, it's worth the gamble. 16th pick. Got Neat Clifford. I love Neat Clifford. This might be too high for him. You see a lot of people still have him in the late first or even the early second, but think about Orlando. They suck at shooting threes. 25th in three-point attempts this season. Last in three-point percentage. They obviously had their struggles in the postseason as well against Boston. Who are they going to take? Like who is the best shooter available at 16? And then they have a pick in the 20s as well. We'll get to that later. Who are they going to take? Are they telling me they're going to take a theoretical shooter, a guy who might be a good shooter 3, 4, 5 years from now? I just don't buy it. I think Neat Clifford has a lot of appeal to some of these teams in this range, whether it's Orlando, whether it's OKC, whether it's San Antonio, whether it's Atlanta, like all these teams right now drafting Chicago at 12, the 12 to 16, even Dallas at 11, all these teams in this range to me make sense for Neat Clifford. And so I have him going to Orlando at number 16. I expect we're going to see him end up in this range after the combine. I think he'd be a player right away for the Orlando Magic. Number 17, this is what I'm saying with some of these prospects we have coming up. Number 17, Will Riley to the Minnesota Timberwolves. 18, Traore going to the Washington Wizards. These guys are theoreticals. They're young guys who flash upside. Minnesota, they did a similar thing with Rob Dillingham last year, trading up for him. That's where I'm following this logic with them taking Will Riley out of Illinois. Just a gamble. You know, maybe Will Riley, you're drafting him a year earlier than he would be a top 10 pick, but he's a gamble. Nolan Traore, been a really up and down year for him overseas, but exactly the same thing here for Washington. You don't get Cooper with the number one pick because I have them falling this year, but in this mock, but with Traore, he's a home run swing. Maybe he turns into something. I got Asa going to the Brooklyn Nets with the 19th pick. They get Cooper with the first pick in this mock. They don't really have much else. I know they have Nick Claxton, but he might not be the long-term guy there. Asa Newell, really good player. I like him a lot out of Georgia, and honestly, wouldn't shock me too much if he ends up going in the lottery. When you think about his versatility, switchable defense with size, 6'11", length, has potential to shoot on offense, offers rim protection, offers switchability. That's valuable. That's valuable in the postseason. And I think a lot of teams might see appeal in that late lottery range. So 19 might be too low for him. Carter Bryant to the Heat with the 20th pick. You know, again, another swing here. I'm not really sure what direction Miami's going to go here. I know, you know, Marcus Morris, I had him on my podcast earlier this week, and he says the Heat are the best team for Giannis. I don't see it. Like, what's the appeal with the Heat right now? Yeah, you got Bam Adebayo. Yeah, you got Tyler Herro. You got Andrew Wiggins. Khalil Ware had a great rookie season in that front court. I had him on one of my all-rookie teams. But are they ready to compete for a championship? I'm not there yet. To me, they're a team that should be taking some swings, and Carter Bryant's one of those guys. Some people have him ranked in the lottery. Others view him as more of a guy in the 20s. Very raw, but very athletic. Shows flashes. I get the Jeff Green comp, Trevor Ariza comp. What I have written here for Jeff Green, Kevin Garnett once said Jeff Green had Hall of Fame potential. I'd imagine fan bases will be tantalized by Bryant's flashes of greatness in a similar fashion. That's where I'm kind of at with Carter Bryant. I see the upside, but I'm not sure about the stardom yet. Good Joan to the Utah Jazz right here. Very raw player here. You know, I think with him, a lot of people have him lottery. A lot of people have him in the 30s. We put him somewhere right now in the middle. Utah taking a swing. Again, they don't get their big earlier in the draft. They take a swing now with a younger guy, somebody that could become a player long term. Yaxel, a lot of people love this guy. Out of UAB. Small mid-major school. He's going to be transferring to Michigan this year, just testing the waters. This dude puts up absurd numbers, like 20 rebound games, 30 point games, you know, near 10 assists as well. It's like Giannis numbers at the mid-major level. I get the Paolo Banchero comp for him in here. And that's not necessarily like a talent level comp. It's more of a style level comp because of how he checks so many different boxes on the team. He's somebody that could very well go back to school, or he rises in the draft and he becomes a lottery pick. Pre-draft workouts, NBA draft combine interviews are going to be more integral for Yaxel than maybe anybody you're going to be seeing in the late first round this year. Maybe more than anybody. Teams are fascinated by him. 6'9" with shot creation ability. If he's there for Atlanta at number 22, could be a potential major steal. 23, the Kalkbrenner, 5-year senior out of Creighton. The Pacers, Miles Turner is going to be a free agent this summer. All their backup fives are going to be free agents as well. So they're going to be in the East semis right now. Got a big series against the Cleveland Cavaliers. But looking ahead here, if they lose their bigs in free agency, even if it's just like Ian Jackson and Thomas Bryant, you're going to need a backup five behind Miles Turner. Kalkbrenner would make a lot of sense for them because he can provide some spacing, provide some rim protection. I love that dude. I think he's going to be a good player, even if he's not drafted until late first or early second. Got Filon to OKC here. Another swing, man. Like, how do they have all these picks? Like, it's just crazy how OKC has all these picks. Honestly, I think this might be the year that OKC consolidates and moves up. That's my bet. This is the year they consolidate picks here. Because how many rookies can you really add? You know, it just doesn't make sense here. But Filon, he's testing the waters out of Alabama. I'm not convinced he's going to enter the draft this year. I think it's going to be depending on, does he get a first round promise? But I like the progress he made this past year at Alabama. He's just not a sure bet quite yet. And that NIL money could be pretty good for him if he ends up returning. Walter Clayton, hero of March Madness out of Florida. If he lands in Orlando, how perfect would that be? Stay in Florida. You get a lot of Gators / Magic fans, I'm sure, that are out there. If he goes to Orlando, a better version of Cole Anthony? Maybe. Maybe. I would hope so. The dude's a bucket getter. So I'd love to see him land in Orlando, help figure out their shooting situation, add some creation. Tahad Pettiford would be a pretty good pick as well. I got Pettiford, another guy testing the waters, going to Brooklyn with one of their two first in the late first round here. We'll get both of those. Hugo Gonzalez as well with the 27th pick. Is Brooklyn going to use all these picks? They basically have a clean slate. I'm not convinced they're going to go use all of their picks this year, but I do think if they end up with Pettiford, Gonzalez, and obviously Cooper in this mock with the first pick, like, you're doing pretty damn good. I love Pettiford. I have him ranked higher than a lot of others do. I think he's a lottery talent, even though his last game for Auburn wasn't great. Reminds me so much of Mike Conley with that offhand floater he has. Left-handed shooter with a right-handed floater. It's gorgeous. And then Hugo Gonzalez, Gavoni, you know, over at ESPN, Draft Express, has him as, I think, in the 20s or the early 20s or late teens. I'm not quite as high on Hugo Gonzalez, but I see the appeal as kind of a 3-and-D style guy. Danny Wolf going to the Boston Celtics. Wolf might end up higher, but I have a hard time finding great fits for him in that 20s range. And plus, he's 21 as a rookie, a little bit older. I'm not sure he's going to shine in pre-draft workouts unless he's fixed his jumper, which has been highly inconsistent throughout college, even prior to his transfer to Michigan. But ultimately, like, the Celtics need a big. Al Horford's getting old. Kristaps Porzingis is injury prone. They got to have another guy in the pipeline that can replace them long term. So that's why I got Wolf going to Boston. Stanford, Maxine Raynaud going to the Phoenix Suns. I love Raynaud here. 7'1" guy. Reminds me of like a Brook Lopez type because he's a big dude that could post up or shoot threes. Where they differ is Raynaud can do a little bit more off the dribble. Great paint protector to me. He's somebody that could raise his draft stock throughout the pre-draft process. And this is what Phoenix needs. Like, they need a big. They need a big. And if they're going to be trying to compete, which I think they're going to, I reported this prior, that the Suns don't really care about getting their own picks back from Houston. But that's because they don't want to bottom out. The Suns want to continue competing, benefit off of the picks of others, and not be a team that sucks and losing, trying to benefit off of their own misery. they want picks from others, if anything, if they're trading Kevin Durant or even Devin Booker. But if they keep any of those guys, Reno is a great fit for them with the 29th pick. Last one here in our first round mock, Rashear Fleming out of St. Joseph's going to the Los Angeles Clippers. Fleming, he'd be a great fit, I think, right away for the Clippers. An upgrade over Ben Simmons, who can't even hit the rim anymore. I mean, boy, I thought the Clippers might actually win that series after that game 3 win, the blowout. I was wrong to believe in the Clippers. I should have known. Decades of history. Just very sad. But Fleming, you know, maybe that's a good consolation prize for them, because Fleming's a baller, dude. Hustles his ass off. Versatile player. He'd be a great fit as a backup 5 for them in place of Ben Simmons. That's what we got for this mock. That's the first round. You can find the second round as well in our NBA draft guide. Check that out. Link in the description below. Big thank you to Nick Wright for joining me on today's episode. We'll be back again on Friday with Tom Havisham talking about everything else at a deeper level. I wanted to get some of these series completed first so Tom and I could go into preview mode with round 2 or potential game 7 previews as well, depending on what happens. So we'll be talking deeper about everything else on Friday with Tom. But I thought this was an awesome conversation today with Nick. I think he's incredible. He's not just a hot take guy like people paint him as. He's got substance behind his thoughts about the game. And I loved the conversation with him. It was one of my favorite pods so far of the playoffs. So big thank you to Nick Wright for joining me on today's episode. And thanks to you for giving us a listen. Give us a 5-star rating if you haven't done so already. And thanks to the team for producing us. Hope you have a great rest of your day. We'll be back again tomorrow with more NBA talk.